Hi, this is Mike Singer for No Map, No Guide, No Limits, and I am here in my house in Seattle, Washington, with my good friend Aiden Lohr. Aiden and I have known each other since about 1992 when we both worked at a seaplane base together, pumping gas and whatnot. And after that, our paths diverged a bit with me working on Flight Simulator at Microsoft and Aiden actually moving into the world of being a pilot, flying up in Alaska. And in the years since, he's done a lot of flying in Alaska and some other flying jobs, and has also more recently become a climbing guide, guiding clients on mountains and rock climbing, both in North America, including up in Alaska, and also in China and Argentina. So we thought we'd just have a little conversation. He's an interesting guy who's living a life that most people don't live and that a lot of people envy. And I thought I would just ask him some questions about why he does what he does and what the upside is and what the downside is. And hopefully you will find it interesting.
If I may interject something,
please.
There, a clarification on how I feel I'm living my life, because people always say it's a how people, other people don't live their life. When you're living a life like this, you're with people who are living the same lifestyle. So it doesn't feel like you're doing anything abnormal. And so I always caution people who say, oh, you're living such an interesting life, because when you're doing this stuff, you're in the midst of it, and everyone around you is doing the same stuff. And so it doesn't feel like you're really doing anything that different.
And in a way, that's a good argument for, or a good way of getting past what might be a fear of a major change to your life. There's a fear of, I'll be alone because nobody I know is pursuing that kind of a dream. But in reality, once you're around the right people doing the thing that you want to be doing, you have a community of people around you.
Yeah, they're all doing it, and occasionally you meet other people who you think are living a more interesting life, and you have to realize that they are probably thinking that, you know, they're in the same boat where it's just their life and the people they're around. I've met a marine biologist who I think has had a fantastic life and still going off on a very interesting life. But I talked to him about it, and he enjoys it. He likes doing what he's doing, but he doesn't view it as anything special. So,
well, let's start with the most basic things that people think about. Like, you know, I own a house. For me, buying my house was a big, scary move for me. You don't own a house.
Yeah, but you buying your house is a big, scary move for me, too.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
So I didn't know if I could come crashing in random moments.
That's right. The old apartment had a junkier couch to sleep on.
Boy, in a new neighborhood here. Lots of changes.
In a typical year for you, what sorts of places are you living in? And when I say living, what are the different environments you sleep in, you hang out in, all that?
Well, I spend a lot of time in the back of my 94 Toyota pickup, and often put that down as an address on places that don't require more than that. That's usually in the Southwest, where I'm in the back of the pickup when I'm just either doing guiding work or personal climbing, and occasionally waiting for some sort of flying work. Southwest, a great place to kind of just wait things through if the weather's good. Also spend time in Alaska, either on a friend's sofa in Anchorage, which is always exciting because they've got a TV with a clicker. And spend time in your guest room that's in the lower floor. And spend a fair amount of time in a hostel up in Talkeetna, Alaska, when I'm guiding. And the company I work for actually owns the hostel, so we've got a little guide shack in the back that used to be the doghouse, for some brief description of what that shack is like.
So for part of the year, you're in the doghouse.
Exactly, for much of the year. And actually, the doghouse is usually so full of people snoring and coming home very late from long nights in the bar, and that leads to other activities in there that you don't really need to be in there while they're occurring. So I spend a lot of time in the work van, which is a big Chevy 350, big benches to sleep on. That's a great place to sleep. Or Occasionally with some of these flying jobs, I end up in really nice, swanky hotels, and it's quite a, it's interesting to go, you know, from the doghouse in Talkeetna mm-hmm. to, if you do these ferry flights and you stay in, there's a hotel you stay in Luxor, Egypt, that's, mm-hmm. it's not that much per night, but if it was in the U.S., it would be, you know, easily a $200 or $300 a night hotel.
Mm-hmm.
You get little suites. It's mm-hmm. quite ritzy in a balcony mm-hmm. that looks out over on the Nile.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of fun to jump between those different living arrangements.
And a lot of the year, you're sleeping in a sleeping bag in a tent.
Yeah, and a lot of the year, less this year, but depends how much I'm guiding. Mm-hmm. The more I'm guiding, you can spend a lot of time, yeah, in a tent, in a sleeping
mm-hmm.
bag.
Mm-hmm. And as an aside, something I've noticed over the years is that, I've always found this interesting because when I, many, many years ago, long before Aiden set off on his adventure career, I, for 2 years, was a sea kayaking guide, and I thought I was headed in that direction forever, but ended up taking a 180 degree turn for a bunch of reasons. But I tended, and still do, if I'm honest with myself, to have a black and white view of outdoor adventure versus indoor normal life. And I've always found it funny that I think of Aiden as an outdoor adventurer. Even when he comes to town, he's always exercising, like going on really long runs and things. And yet, he takes extraordinarily long showers. And I'm curious if this is true. It's kind of like you're completely comfortable being completely grimy and dirty and having none of the conveniences of civilized life, so to speak. Yet, when you're in this world, you take advantage of it, partially because you don't get to the rest of the year.
Yeah, I think there are a few reasons. I mean, one example is a friend of mine who I guide with. He's in the Cascades right now guiding a bunch, and you know, last night I called him up, just going to see if he wanted to have a beer or something, but he had just gotten a hotel room for the night and wanted to do nothing but lie in bed watching TV. Mm-hmm. He'd just been in the mountains for 12 days,
mm-hmm.
and there's definitely, when you come out of sort of rustic environments, it can be very nice to enjoy some of the...
Mm-hmm.
the aspects of civilization that maybe you don't appreciate when they're more readily available, or that like watching TV is a big one that I generally would say watching TV is a waste of time, but
mm-hmm.
there are times when you're tired and you're done in the mountains where it's, you just want to turn everything off.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of those little treats of civilization are nice.
Mm-hmm.
Do you
view yourself as, you know, an adventurer, as, you know, you fly too, so that's more the adventure side, but, you know, as an outdoor athlete? And if so, the second part of the question is, do you have this image in your mind of what that is? Because a lot of people who don't do that sort of thing and don't live that sort of life, you know, and it's largely fueled by advertising and movies and things, people have an image of what that means, and I used to have that very strongly, even when I was doing it for a living for a couple of years, and I always found myself shocked when I would discover that, you know, one of the best climbers in the world is actually a corporate lawyer.
Well, a few things that with climbing, traditionally, the high altitude mountaineering, at least, was often done by lawyers, doctors. There's no funding. You didn't have sponsorship, or it was sponsored by like the American Alpine Club, or it was sponsored by national clubs. But often they were self-funded. And so like Jim Wickwire, who lived in Seattle, one of the premier U.S. high-altitude climbers in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, was a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he worked on the North Slope with Native Alaskans mm-hmm. quite a bit when they were opening up Prudhoe Bay and all the oil rights issues in the 70s. So there's a history in climbing of professionals climbing.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably only more recently, and this did start in Yosemite, probably in the 50s, where you had people in Yosemite just kind of hanging out, dirt bags, they would call them, where you just hang out, work a minimum amount, and just climb all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's become more popular. A lot of college students do it, not it's dirt bagging, but they also have a financial network because they're in school usually.
Mm-hmm.
The parents aren't supporting their climbing, but they're still supporting school. That continues. I have guiding friends who certainly spend a lot of time living a lot cheaper than I do. So I don't know, I guess part of the question there is an outdoor athlete. I don't know if I'd view myself that way.
Mm-hmm.
They're things I want to accomplish, and the way to get to those things is to, you have to do other things to get to, you know, you sort of
mm-hmm.
building blocks to get up
mm-hmm.
to them. And in terms of the exercise, it's just something I sort of have to do to maintain my sanity, and that certainly helps climbing out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll train for climbs if I get the chance. A lot of my work precludes any regular training, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I wouldn't consider myself an adventurer or an athlete.
Now, that's interesting because, you know, let's look at objectively, you know, some of the things you do. So you climb mountains and rock climb for fun at a pretty advanced level. You do that for work to make money. You've been a bush pilot in Alaska for thousands of hours, which is rumored to be, you know, one of the riskiest jobs and things like that. So what I'm interested in is not objectively whether these things are truly adventure or not, but just from your perception, you know, other people think of you as an adventurous person. It sounds like you don't view yourself that way.
Right. I think people pigeonhole groups of activities and people who do them into certain categories.
Mm-hmm.
Like even you mentioned bush pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I have talked about this frequently, where I don't actually believe that bush pilot's really an accurate modern name for almost anything in Alaska. There are a very few people who do the bush pilot type
mm-hmm.
flying. But I feel like in reality that probably died out in
mm-hmm.
the 70s in
mm-hmm.
terms of what a bush pilot actually was.
Mm-hmm.
You could argue that, that you're still flying to what they call bush villages, but you're landing on gravel strips that are well established. Even the glacier flying, we've talked about
mm-hmm.
this. Generally, pilots are landing on in areas that they've established as a good place to land.
Mm-hmm.
Often, runways are marked out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to make a category, you'd probably say that, I'm having an adventurous life. But it doesn't feel that way when you're living it. I don't think it's.
Right.
I've never felt like it was really an accurate description. You're doing things you enjoy doing.
So it sounds then that you are not living this life because it's an adventurous life and that's what you wanted. It sounds more like, you know, you have a vision in your mind of, I want to climb a mountain like this. I want to have a job flying this kind of flight in this kind of place. And therefore, my life becomes A, B, C, and D in order to do that. If people think that's adventurous, maybe it is, but that's not why you decided to do it.
Right. I want to keep having different experiences.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably another way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, I'm just straight traveling I'd like to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd love to go to Pompeii. I always say
mm-hmm.
that, and I'd never go.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't view it as an adventure. I mean, I think everybody has their own little moments that are probably more exciting for them.
Mm-hmm.
Like my sister lives in Brooklyn, and she used to talk about New York. Well, even recently, I just talked to her. Somebody's bugged outside her house. My father saw it. And she always says, living in New York is an adventure right there. You don't need more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything, you know, you've got all kinds of events that could happen that are sort of beyond your control, but it's all people, not all bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's not all muggings and crime. A lot of good events that occur as well. An interesting life is what I,
mm-hmm.
what I'm striving for, or what mm-hmm. I would like to have. And we've talked about that. You
mm-hmm.
you read somewhere at one point that somebody said or wrote that the
was,
key to an
yeah.
interesting life is to acquire many skills and use them.
Yeah, I think it was Stuart Brand, the editor of the original Whole Earth catalog, way back in the 70s, I believe.
Well, I think that's a fantastic example of maybe not an example, but a way to keep having different experiences. I mean, if you're going to
mm-hmm.
acquire it, and it doesn't have to be as a job. You could go learn how to scuba dive
right.
and go diving once a year.
Yeah.
That's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it's for me, it might be learning how to use a computer. That's a challenge, right there.
Yeah, that's true.
That may be a bigger challenge.
You don't consider yourself any sort of adrenaline junkie then, or anything like that?
No. No, I just have things that I really want to do, and some of them are might be higher risk. But everybody's acceptance of risk is different. Like I just mentioned, my sister, I'm not going to be real comfortable walking down a street in New York City at night, possibly where she might be real comfortable doing it. So you're, the way you view risk is different. And if you, anytime you get more familiar with a certain type of risk, I think your acceptance of it usually increases. Once you understand what that risk is, because generally it's not as high risk as the perception from people who don't do that activity.
So do you consider the activities you do for both work and fun risky?
Some of them are, yeah. I mean, I've talked a bunch last year about that trip to China, which I think mentally I'm still working through that. I think I've kind of gotten over it. All spring.
That was the trip you did by yourself?
Yeah, where I was in a tent for 25 days by myself. And it wasn't being in the tent that was the problem, but the climbing is pretty... there's a lot of objective hazard, a lot of hazard you can't control in terms of avalanches, rockfall. And then the climbing itself is a lot of loose snow over rock. So even though you can make the moves, the medium that you're climbing on might give way. And then you're going to fall no matter how good you are, because everything you're walking on is gone. I suspect that there are other climbers out there with more experience in that type of terrain who would have gone right over the terrain and said, hey, this is nothing, we just keep going. And if I went back again, which I plan to, maybe not this year, maybe next year, understanding that that's what the terrain's going to be like, I suspect I'd be much more willing to accept it. And deal with it different. There are ways to deal with it mentally and actually really try to minimize the danger or the hazards. But that's the way to look at it. Instead of looking at it as it's all just trying to minimize the hazards that you face. I mean, nobody wants to get really hurt or die. Then you can't do it anymore. So you have to look at your objective, and then you may accept that there's a certain level of danger inherent in what you are doing, but you will work hard to minimize that danger, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And is that the same with flying?
Yeah, flying's exactly the same.
Yeah, and just to be clear, we're talking about flying mostly fairly small airplanes. The biggest plane you fly now is what, like seven seats, nine seats?
Nine seaters usually is what I end up in. I think a lot of this decision making is pretty similar, even if when I was flying the tankers, the fuel hauling job, where you're flying a four engine transport category aircraft, but you're flying it in the same style you'd fly a small plane, smaller runways, usually not any instrument approaches, so. Fewer official channels of flying in bad weather.
Right. So speaking of risk, perceived or otherwise, have you had moments in both arenas, flying and climbing, where you just have this moment where you're like, "What? Either what am I doing here, or what the hell was I thinking, or... oh no...
Well, the what am I doing here usually involves when I'm doing something that I just don't want to be doing. There's not usually any danger inherent. It's more along like going to a party I don't want to go to. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, what am I doing here? Yeah, it's usually just getting involved in usually social situations that I just don't want to be there. But you can't get out of it.
Right.
In terms of flying or climbing, there are definitely moments where you usually get yourself into trouble. You know, rarely is it trouble that just sprang up on you out of nowhere. You know, like the wing doesn't just, rarely just falls off an airplane.
Right.
Some jobs, they do sometimes fall off airplanes, firebombing being one. But So with climbing, you'll get there. You get to a moment where you're like, wow, this is, I've gotten it over my head. And you usually the immediate next step is to figure out how to get yourself out of it. So there's not a whole lot of time to really beat yourself up. It's more like, okay, now we need to start working to get this back to a better spot. Flying that way, this ferry flying, this airplane delivery stuff is a little more that way, because the flights are very long. So once you commit to them, there's a point where you're sort of committed, mm-hmm. and your options are fewer for getting out of a bad situation.
Right. For clarity, that's flying like over the Atlantic, delivering planes to Europe and Africa and things like that.
It's usually the single engine ones. I mean, in twin, you've got more options.
Yeah.
And that job's fun. You just, I always say, I feel it requires less flying skill
mm-hmm.
and more planning skill,
mm-hmm.
because you don't actually. It's not about manipulating the controls of the aircraft, unlike flying in Alaska, where it's
right.
more about physical flying
right.
skills. The ferry flying is more about planning, and
mm-hmm.
it's all about picking your weather windows. And you might just, if you choose to launch off in a bad weather, you've got to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you just have to
mm-hmm.
keep going. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you don't have a whole lot of options, and you decide to fly in that weather, so it's your own fault. But then you might get a moment where you're like, what was I thinking?
Right.
Flying in Alaska is a little bit different. The flights tend to be shorter. You might get into a situation like that, but usually you get out of it pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like, wow, this is really bad. I don't want to be here. And you can usually get yourself out of there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, flying is interesting. I talk about this with climbing friends, but they'll try to compare climbing and flying. And especially big alpine climbs, your danger period could last days. Whereas with flying, you're limited by your fuel. And the ferry flying is a little bit worse because you might have 21 hours of fuel on the plane. So you've got 21 hours to deal with these problems. As opposed to most small planes, you're up in Alaska or even the lower 48, anywhere, you have 5-6 hours of fuel.
Right.
And whatever problem you've got is going to be resolved at the end of that time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a finite amount of time,
mm-hmm.
whereas climbing tends to, you don't know when it's going to end
mm-hmm.
with climbing. It can drag on and on.
Mm-hmm. In all these activities, it definitely sounds like you're not seeking out those oh my god moments, because for some people, or so they say, that's the attraction and that's why they do it. For you, in these different activities, when are the moments when you feel the best, when you're happiest, or is there one, or is it just the entire life that you like?
Oh, there are moments. I wouldn't say in flying. I mean, flying, I like flying. I like it as a job, but I don't. It's a good job
mm-hmm.
that I enjoy and has some. There's some problem solving I enjoy with it, but there are very few moments. There are a few moments in flying, like you get a good sunrise, or I always pull up one flight. I'd get out of COTS, and it was probably 10 at night in the wintertime, so it's. It's dark out. I mean, it wasn't really dark was the thing, but there was a full moon on one side. The comet Hale-Bopp was in the middle of the sky, and the northern lights were going on in the north.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those moments mm-hmm. you just don't see if you're not up
right.
there flying. Anyway, those are pretty cool. And actually, that might have been a mountain bike ride. I had a flight that was similar, with no Hale-Bopp, but the mountain bike ride, I had Hale-Bopp out, and I kept riding the bike, but. Same sort of thing with flying. You have moments where you're just like, wow, this is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Or a sunrise over the Atlantic. You're just
mm-hmm.
like, or, even there's always this ridge of thunderstorms in mid-Atlantic. And
mm-hmm.
in a 172, you're sort of flying right through them. And usually in the dark. And so you can't really tell where you are, but you get flashes of lightning and you'll see there are these big caverns in the clouds. And
mm-hmm.
That's kind of cool, but they're very short moments. With climbing, climbing is more of a fusion of mind and body where things suddenly
mm-hmm.
are really meshing well. Runners, we call it the runner's high. And I think with running, it's a mix of the endorphins that are being released in your body. And I think it's more than that with climbing. So it's not, you're not always moving really fast, but you're usually moving smooth. It's how your body's working with your brain and
mm-hmm.
you're interacting with the rock, and that's all. But again, you get the last time that was really going well was two summers ago now.
Yeah.
And that's my projects this year are kind of going back and attempting some of, not the same climbs, but similar style of climbs, just a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. And some of these climbs will not happen if I can't achieve that sort of spot, because right. they have to go fast. And mm-hmm. That's a great place to be when things are really flowing well like that. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you're not thinking about danger. You're not. Right. Those climbs have some fairly high hazard for various reasons, but they're those particular climbs I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But that's not why you're doing them. You're not doing them for the risk. You're doing them for that sort of flow and the mm-hmm. the feeling you get from it. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what adrenaline junkies are.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Many years ago, I wrote an essay in which it was about my time as a kayaking guide, and I actually pointed to it from a blog post a couple months ago. It ended with the concept that there are certain experiences that are only available to those who are willing to have them. And I fell in love with that phrase back then. And what you just described, for example, you know, being on a mountain bike, seeing the comet and the northern lights and all of that, you know, had you been in a house watching TV in Seattle, you couldn't have had that experience. So an interesting follow-up question to all that is, do you view yourself as making sacrifices in order to be in the right place at the right time, in order to have these experiences you couldn't have unless you were having them? Or do you not even view it as sacrifices because you've never really lived any other way?
I think that the difference is I live the way I want to live. Mm-hmm. And so I have this type of experiences, and they're the ones I like. I value these type of experiences. Other people would get a very similar feeling of satisfaction, fulfillment, achievement, having a totally different experience, having a really good job that pays well, you know, or having a family. I mean, it's just different people value different types of experiences. I think the type of activities I do, people tend to glamorize and look at and think that they're more intense experiences, but I don't think they are. I think they're just different. You know, my sister has a family, mm-hmm. and I suspect for her, and she loves her job, and does, a lot of good stuff with her job. She's great at it, mm-hmm. and I suspect she gets every bit out of doing her job and having a family that I get out of doing my jobs and being able to go wherever I want, whenever mm-hmm. I want, which is that's the advantage of not having a family mm-hmm. Or a partner. You can kind of just do your own thing. Mm-hmm. So I don't really feel like I've sacrificed anything, because I don't think I could have done it any other way. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I had, and you know this, you know mm-hmm. me well enough, if I had a family, sure, I'd work it out. It'd be like, you know, if I'd had children, I'd be like, okay, well, this is what we just have to do. But I've chosen not to do that, mm-hmm. more or less. And if I chose to do it, boy, I mean, if it was, there's a very good chance it would be very frustrating for mm-hmm. me, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't be gaining anything. It would be giving up a lot. Mm-hmm. The alternate being, you find a partner who'll do this kind of stuff with you.
Right.
That's something I haven't really explored that much, but that might be pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Who knows?